Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. I'm Tim Watt, and as always, I'm joined by my dad, John Watt. Hi, John.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And we're really excited today to have another guest on the show. That's Melody Redman. Melody, do you want to start by introducing yourself and saying a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Hi, everybody. My name's Melody Redman. I'm a doctor, so I am specialising in clinical genetics. So I'm a clinical genetics registrar working in the north of England.
Brilliant. We're really pleased to have Melody on the show because we wanted to spend this episode and next week's show digging into genetics, and in particular a new kind of NHS program about screening newborns. But before we get into all of that, Melody, do you want to explain a bit more about what it is a geneticist does in the NHS? What does an average day look like for you?
So clinical genetics is quite a small specialty in the NHS, so there aren't that many of us around, and we tend to work in regional centres where we'll cover quite a big geographical patch. So we're mainly based at some of the kind of bigger hospitals, but then we'll often go and do clinics at some of the smaller hospitals as well. So the way that our job works is our time is balanced spent between seeing patients directly ourselves, which would either be in an outpatient clinic or seeing maybe an unwell baby or an unwell child on the neonatal or paediatric intensive care unit. And then the rest of our time is spent advising other clinicians and other doctors to try and help them find the right genetic test for their patient and help them trying to get to the bottom of what might be going on. So really our role is about trying to help find answers for people with rare diseases that might be caused by a problem, a change in the genetic code.
So, Melody, we know one another for some years, and you chose fairly on to specialise in this area of genetics, didn't you? So what was it about it that interested you and drew you into it?
Yes, so before I worked in clinical genetics, I worked for a few years in paediatrics, children's medicine, and one of the things that I really I'm interested in is the kind of interplay between science and technologies and healthcare. And one of the things that's really interesting about clinical genetics is we're constantly kind of at the forefront of science, and there's constantly new advances in technology and genetic testing that's available. And I find that really interesting from kind of an ethical point of view, thinking about how technology should be used. But then also it's a specialty where communication is really important, because often we'll be seeing patients and families at really challenging points in their lives. We may be breaking some bad news to them about a result, and they might have some challenging decisions to make about once they've found out what that result is. So I really value that it's a mixture of science and quite heavy on the communication skills.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because in my job previously working as a paediatrician, it was a similar kind of mix. And often you have this very stressful and but on the other hand, a great privilege when you're having very difficult and sometimes very painful conversations with parents, aren't you? And explaining what the testing has shown and trying to explain what the implications might be. How do you find those conversations? Have you had much experience of that so far?
I think you're absolutely right that it's a challenge, but it's a privilege, and conversations that we might have nearly every day for that family, it will be a conversation that they remember for the rest of their lives. And that's quite humbling to have that opportunity to really kind of engage with someone at a really vulnerable time. It is challenging, and I think one of the important things is for me to constantly remind myself that even though I may be behind on my clinic list, I may be running over time and things, it's really important to give each individual family and each individual patient the time that they need, because it is, you know, going to be such a important encounter for them.
Yeah, and I think that I've had experience where parents have relayed back to me what other doctors have said, and because, you know, some doctor just happened to use an insensitive phrase or said something very pessimistic about their child, it's often those kind of insensitive comments which probably at the time the doctor didn't think much about, but which can haunt a parent, can't they, even for months or years.
Yes, it's so true. We have to be so careful about the words we use. And I know certainly that's something that I often find challenging. And I often think, oh gosh, I wish I hadn't quite phrased it like that. And again, quite a large part of my job is also writing letters. And for me, it's really important to really go over my letters very carefully, thinking about how it might possibly be interpreted. Because obviously, in letter writing, that's a different communication skill, because people don't hear the tone with which you're writing the letter. So yes, it's really important to be very careful in the words that we're using.
That's a real difference in clinical practice, isn't it? Because most of my career, when I was working, we wrote letters to other doctors and health professionals, but by and large, the parents didn't see the letters we wrote. Whereas these days, the normal practice is for parents to receive a copy of anything you write, don't you? So as a result, you have to be really much more careful about how you phrase things and how parents might interpret this.
Indeed, most of my letters I actually write to the patient and then copy in other doctors. And I think that that's quite important when we're using a lot of complex terminology that we use in genetics. And it's a delicate balance to make sure we're communicating sensitively, but also including all of the information that's necessary so that all of the other doctors are up to date with what's going on as well.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the complexity of the field. I imagine most people you're engaging with, most patients, have never had a genetic consultation or thought much about their genes before they're kind of forced to by medical circumstance. How do you go about trying to explain some of the nuances? I think most people, if anything, a bit like me, who maybe studied genes at school briefly in their science classes and have this vague idea that we have these bits of code inside our cells which determine certain aspects of our bodies, but not much more beyond that. How do you go about explaining to someone in kind of non-medical terms what the gene that you found is and what it might be saying about their future?
So it's really important in every consultation to include quite a big chunk of time just explaining concepts, and then again reinforcing that with any letters that I send out. And we have a lot of sort of information leaflets that we can give families as well. But I think I always try and start from a very basic assumption of someone's knowledge, and then I always tell people that they can tell me if they know what I'm trying to explain to them. But it's always better to assume that people are starting from a very basic level, especially when they might be quite nervous seeing a doctor, and they, you know, don't want to appear uninformed. And it's really helpful to use things like pictures and images. So quite often I use a sort of analogy of genes being like little instruction manuals or recipe books that help our bodies know how to grow and how to develop. And we have a whole library of these instruction manuals or recipe books. And so analogies like that can be really quite helpful. And again, using that with pictures to help explain it to families, and just kind of trying to recognise at what stage their understanding is can be quite helpful as well.
I guess it seems like, from my perspective, you know, we see more and more talk about gene therapies and genetic medicine in the news, and there seems quite a lot of research and excitement about this as a kind of new frontier for for treating people, about, you know, understanding their genes and then tailoring particular treatments or medicines based on that. Is that at all part of your work or research as well, that kind of field?
In my area of clinical genetics, we're more involved in trying to reach the diagnosis. And then once we've helped the patients reach the diagnosis, quite often we'll then pass them on further to, if they want to be involved with research teams, or if there are in some very specific genetic conditions, if there are therapies that are available for them, then we'll be linking them up with other doctors who can provide those. But our role is more in trying to reach the diagnosis.
So this is one of the big issues, isn't it, in this whole field, is that although in theory, and it's I sometimes call this word precision medicine, the idea being that using the genetic information will allow doctors to target therapies absolutely to you as an individual. Although that's a great theory, in reality, the majority of the genetic variants that you're detecting and communicating to parents, there isn't any kind of particular therapy that's currently available. Is that fair enough?
That's absolutely right. So the majority of genetic conditions that we diagnose, the treatment that will be available will be sort of supportive treatments, i.e. we can't stop the condition progressing, but we can often intervene in ways. So if we know that a certain genetic condition, for example, is associated with kidney problems, then we might advise a kidney scan to check for any of those. There are several genetic conditions, for example, epilepsy disorders, things like that, where there might be treatments that we know work better in certain conditions rather than in other conditions. And certainly the role for treating genetic conditions is expanding. And, you know, there are lots of research studies going on. And there are some specific conditions, such as spinal muscular atrophy, where there are specific interventions that can be used. But there are also lots of other possible impacts of having a diagnosis. So it's not just about being able to access treatment. The other things that might be involved are just having an understanding of this, of what condition they have, and being able to link up with other families who have the same condition. We can often do personalized letters for school to help them get the right sort of support. They might be able to access screening for other conditions that are associated with their genetic diagnosis, and there might be implications for other family members. And also there are then options available for families to decide if they're wanting to extend their family further or have children, thinking about reproductive options that are available as well.
Do you find it difficult that a lot of this work is really, as far as I understand, is based on probabilities? And I think the lay understanding of genes is that if you have gene Y, it will cause consequence X. In most cases, it's such a bit more complex than that. And we're talking about gene Y increases the probability that you might have consequence X. And do you find it difficult to kind of communicate that clearly to patients?
Yeah, so there are over 20,000 genes that we have, and genes are in almost every cell of our body. And the way that genes interact are just hugely complicated, and there's so much that we've still got to learn about genetics and how the body works. And it's such a hugely expanding field with so many unknowns at the moment. And in our role in clinical genetics, we're mainly looking at conditions where a change in one gene, one of those 20,000 genes, could lead to an illness, a disorder. But not all of those conditions occur in every single person with that genetic change. That's something that we talk about. We call it variable penetrance, and some individuals with that genetic change might not have the disorder, whereas others with the genetic change would. And most of the conditions that we see in clinical genetics have a higher penetrance, i.e. if someone has that genetic change, they are more likely to have the disorder. But, you know, even within genetics, so for example, within cancer genetics, which is a specialty within genetics, that again is looking at percentage chances of developing cancer over the course of your lifetime. And so it can be hugely complicated information for individuals to try and process.
And do you sometimes feel that giving this information when someone is a baby or a child, you know, giving information to parents and so on, that it might actually have unintended bad consequences. Are you aware of that as a possibility?
In children where they are experiencing lots of different features, I think getting a diagnosis is nearly always helpful for families, because they can say, rather than listing all of the features that the child has, they can say, my child has this condition, and that can be really empowering for families. However, there are definite challenges with that. So first of all, if they have a very, very rare disease where there is only a few children in the whole world with that condition, actually, all of a sudden, they've got a very, very small support network. And it might be that there's only a handful of patients known with that, and they suddenly feel very isolated. Whereas when they have a general genetic undiagnosed condition, there's a very, very large national support group for that, called Syndromes Without a Name, which is a fantastic organisation. So it can be isolating to find that an individual has a very rare genetic condition. And then there are also other challenges. So if we look at the inheritance of that genetic condition, it may be that it's new in a child for the first time. It may be that they have inherited it from their parents, and that can cause lots of problems with guilt and parents feeling it's my fault, even though actually they obviously had no choice in passing on that condition and didn't know about that. And then also it does pose really challenging questions about sharing genetic information within families. So if there are implications potentially for other family members, and challenging decisions about what to do in the future about having other children, and if there is a risk of a future child also having that condition.
So this is one of the fascinating things about why genetics is different from other kind of medical diagnoses, isn't it? So if I'm diagnosed with some kind of problem, you know, usually a medical problem, usually that has implications for me and my future, but it doesn't really have any direct implications for anyone else. But if I'm diagnosed with a genetic and inherited genetic variant, then potentially that has life-changing implications, doesn't it, for other people, for my siblings, for my parents, for my children, for the whole extended family. And how you navigate that must be extremely complex.
It's very complicated for families indeed, and particularly, you know, we live in a society where families are very complicated, they're blended, there's lots of different people involved, and sometimes, sadly, you know, people have lost contact with other family members, and it does raise lots of difficult questions. So should someone's genetic information remain private to them, or should they have to share that information when there's potential health impacts for others? And in our kind of Western, very individualistic society, we may feel that actually that information should be private to us. However, there are implications for other family members, and certainly as doctors, we also have to kind of very carefully weigh up the potential risks and consequences for other family members if that information isn't shared.
So are there times as a doctor where you have a duty to breach confidentiality? So even if your patient is saying, look, you know, we've made this diagnosis, but I don't want anyone else in the family to know, are there situations where it would be right to override that and tell other people?
So we try wherever possible to maintain a patient's confidentiality. But a couple of years ago, there was a High Court case, which was ABC versus St George's University Hospital NHS Foundation Trust, if anyone wants to go away and read about it. And to very briefly summarise that, the implications of that, it does bring sort of a complexity now around the balancing act of considering maintaining a patient's confidentiality with the potential risks and consequences to other family members. And it is something that we, as clinical geneticists, have to actively consider. I haven't clinically had the experience of having to breach anyone's confidentiality, but I have had complex discussions within my team, and we would kind of, you know, we wouldn't leave this on one person's shoulders. We would have a team discussion about this is the situation. This patient doesn't want to share information. What can or should we do about this? And I think quite often patients who are initially reluctant to share information within a family, we can often find ways of helping them to do that in a more delicate way, and sometimes in a way where they themselves might not be directly named. So it's a hugely complicated area, and I think I would, you know, really want to reassure anyone listening to this that if they see a clinical geneticist, that wherever possible, confidentiality is upheld, and whenever information is shared, that is normally through them as a family member. We would encourage them to share the information, but it is definitely a complicated area.
I guess there are some conditions in which you might identify a gene, but it doesn't kind of come into play, as it were, or cause a condition until later in life, but it's still kind of untreatable, uncurable. Have you come across situations where maybe your parents have said, do you know what, I don't want to tell my child that they have this gene that will later in life make them very sick or maybe even kill them? Like, what good is that information going to do them? Let's just let them be happy, and, you know, when it happens, it happens, rather than having it hanging over their heads.
Tim, you've highlighted a really important area about genetic testing, and just to kind of expand that a little bit further, so quite a lot of the patients that we see are children, and when we're doing genetic testing in children, or in anyone for that matter, one of the potential outcomes is always that we may find what we call an incidental or unexpected finding. What I mean by that is we're looking for a reason to explain what's going on with that patient, that child probably, but actually, because of the way that the genetic testing works, we find something that might not be relevant to them at that time. So an example would be that if we were testing a child using kind of quite a broad panel of genetic testing, we might identify that actually they carry a gene change in a gene called BRCA1, which is something that's been in the media headlines a lot over the last few years, which is a predisposition to breast and ovarian cancer. Now, the thing with that gene change is that the risks associated with that only really start in adulthood. And we've now found this information out in a child who, you know, otherwise that information wouldn't have come to light. And that's hugely complicated, because not only is there then implications for that child in their future, and, you know, it's a hugely complicated area about how we decide to disclose that information and you know, at what point in life it's right to do that. But also, as we kind of alluded to earlier, that gene change might have been inherited from either the mother or father, and there could be implications for other family members. So actually, we've been looking for a cause of a child's problem, and actually we've opened up a whole other area within the family that actually becomes really important to pursue further.
That sounds really complex and murky, and I guess a new, as Dad was saying, a novel medical dilemma that previous generations of doctors didn't have to wrestle with.
Yeah, and I think the general view has been that if this genetic information is going to affect a child while they're still a child, then yes, it has to be released and dealt with, and people are informed. If, on the other hand, it's going to affect them when they're an adult, by and large, we should wait until the person reaches 18 and then ask them, you know, do you want to know? We know something about you. We've got your genetic information. Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, is that what happens, Melody?
So depending on what we found, we would then again, as a team, have a discussion about the wording that's on the genetic report, for example. So sometimes we can sensitively word it and say, we found out something that will be of relevance for when this child is an adult. Please encourage them to come back to us at an age appropriate time. So sometimes we can kind of delay that sharing of information. But in general, if we as doctors know something about the genetic results, generally we would want to share that with families, because we don't want to kind of be hiding information. In the example that I just used of the breast and ovarian cancer predisposition, that actually, even though might not be relevant for that child at that point in time, it might be of relevance now for that child's mother. And so things like that can make it much more complicated, because even though for that child, we might not want to kind of share that information right now when they're 2 years old and it's of absolutely no relevance to them, but actually we might need to share it within the wider family. And so again, that's hugely complicated, and it's very much, you know, we take individual approaches when we get these complex findings. And again, it's always done as kind of a team. But yeah, I mean, there are just huge challenges that it's really difficult to decide what's best to do on.
I guess the other thing about genes is that they store other incidental information that you might not be looking for. I mean, a classic example, I don't know if you've ever come across this or heard of this, is when you test both the parents and a child and discover that, contrary to the story being presented, the child might not be genetically related to one of their parents. And then who do you share that information with if it was discovered by accident and that kind of thing? Is that a live concern?
That is a very live concern, and indeed I have come across that in families. And when we are doing a form of testing called whole genome sequencing, which I can explain more about later, but when we do that form of testing, ideally we should compare the child with both of their biological parents, because it helps the lab interpret the results. And whenever we do that form of testing, we always tell families that this will reveal whether or not you are the true biological parents. And there is ongoing discussions sort of nationally as to if that should always be shared within the family. So for example, if we found a case of non-paternity where the dad was compared to the child sample and actually we saw that they were not genetically related, there are ongoing discussions as to in what circumstances should that information be shared. And it might not always be shared if we do find that, but it may be that it is of clinical relevance to share that information if there are risks to other people in the family, for example. So yes, it's a hugely complicated area, something that we always warn families about. And then if we do find that, again, it's a discussion of weighing up all of the kind of potential consequences of if we do share that information.
Okay, we're kind of coming towards the end of this this week's podcast, but I wanted to ask before we close, how does your kind of faith interact with your work in this field? I mean, it feels like a lot about genetics is quite deterministic. It's a lot about, you know, saying what is baked into your cells from the moment you were conceived is telling the story of your future life. Do you ever wrestle with that as a Christian, as a believer who thinks that actually there's a bigger story in the universe at play here, or how else might your faith interact with your work?
I think that my faith is a huge reason that I went into this line of work as well. And I think that it's a really challenging area. And certainly as a Christian, I just have such a great hope within me that even though there are so many problems in the genome and we all have problems in our genetic code, you know, I have this eternal hope that there will be a time where there'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, and the old order of things will have passed away, which is from Revelation. So I have that hope in the future. But also I do, you know, as a Christian, constantly weigh up all of these sort of ethical implications of decisions that we make. And again, thinking of the technologies that we use and what is the best way to use them. And, you know, I believe that with almost all technologies that we have, there are positive ways to use them, and there are ways that can be more harmful or that can promote health inequalities or have other kind of unintended consequences. And so for me, it's really important to be weighing up those things regularly, sort of discussing them with other Christians, and then trying to have a voice on things where I think it's important to speak out about them.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities, you'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Today we wanted to move the conversation on to a particular new program that's just starting in the NHS. It's called the Newborn Genomes Program, and it's a plan the NHS is currently kind of consulting on and exploring and hoping to get up running, which would sequence and analyze the genomes of newborn babies. If I'm right, there already is some limited analysis of newborns screened for a few conditions. Is that right, Melody?
Yes, that's correct. So on day five of life, normally, as many parents who are listening to this might remember, the baby will have a little heel prick test done, and then that little bit of blood will get sent off. And we normally look for about 9 conditions that would be important to know about as a baby, because there's important implications for treatments that can really affect that baby growing up.
So I guess what's important to make clear is the way that kind of gene testing works is that you don't, once you get someone's, you know, a sample of someone's blood, you don't just stick it in and then look for the whole and identify all 20,000 genes that we talked about last week. But you normally look for what's called a panel of particular genes. And so is the change in this new NHS program is that it would be looking for much, much broader range than just the current 9 conditions.
So the testing would be called whole genome sequencing, and I think it's helpful to just explore what that means a little bit. So whole genome sequencing, so the genome is all of our complete set of genetic information, which includes our 20,000 or so genes. And so that's sequencing, i.e. storing the information around the DNA code of the whole of our genome. However, even though all of that information would be sequenced from a kind of laboratory point of view, not all of that information is analysed, because there's just so much information there. So what you would do instead is you would apply a panel of genes, i.e. you would only be looking at a certain number of genes, and you'd just analyse if is there anything that stands out, any unusual variation in those genes.
And is the intent in this simply to try and capture more unusual conditions beyond those 9 that we already look for? Is it just simply about saying we now have a technology, or it's affordable enough to actually look much broader than the original 9? Or is there kind of a bigger vision behind this program?
There is a big vision behind this program, which I'll talk about. But just to say that some of this is all kind of subject to change a little bit, because the official pilot for this isn't due to start for another few months yet. So it's due to start in mid-2023. So some of the information is not fully decided yet. So, for example, it is not decided how many genes would be looked at and how many genetic conditions would be looked at. So that is still to be decided. There are 3 main aims of the project. So the first aim that they talk about is identifying rare disease in babies. And the pilot that they'd be doing would be trying to understand how feasible it is to use this test as a way to identify rare and important diseases in babies. And so, you know, as part of that, for example, they'd be looking at how many false positives do we find where we find a genetic change that we think might be relevant, and have to do further testing on that baby, but then it turns out not to be relevant. a second strand, a second aim that they have is about research and trying to understand better, more about genomic information and how we use that kind of big data, and also then potentially opening the door for further treatments, and sort of the development of new drugs for these conditions that can occur in childhood. Then the third aim of the project is to look about creating a sort of a lifetime resource where the genomic data would be stored across that individual's lifetime. And that's kind of thinking about sort of ethical aspects there, about sort of risks and benefits of storing that information and what are the practical implications and ethical implications for that family. So one part of it is about trying to diagnose these conditions, and then the other two parts are looking at research and using it as a lifetime resource.
So it is an extraordinary new kind of development, isn't it? In a way, people have been talking about this for a long time, but it's interesting that Genomics England should be one of the pioneers in terms of planning to take every single baby, obtain a DNA sample shortly after birth, both analyse it to look for rare diseases, but also then put it away, lock it away in the laboratory so that for the rest of your life, the rest of this child's life, the DNA is there stored and potentially available.
Yes, I mean, it's a hugely complex area, and you know, it's something that's been really important to watch evolve and contribute to discussions wherever possible, because actually this would be a huge shift from what we're doing currently. And there are all sorts of potential implications about storing this data. And, you know, for example, the parents would be consenting on behalf of the baby. And so how do we then manage that? Do we go back to the child when they're 16 and say, okay, now you can decide, are you happy for this data to still be stored? And, you know, who should really have the rights over that genetic information? And also, where do we draw the line in things that we want to identify? Should we be identifying things that will only affect the child when they're a baby, or should we set an age of, well, you know, if it's a condition that appears before the age of 5, then that should be our threshold for identifying these conditions. And I think, you know, one of the really interesting, well, challenging areas really will be looking at how it impacts that parent's development of the relationship with their child. So if you know your child's going to develop a serious condition from, you know, around the age of 5, although of course we can never predict these things exactly, then actually does that affect the way that you bond with the child, the way that you treat them as a baby, even though there's no direct implications at that time? It's hugely challenging, and, you know, there's so many big questions around this.
One of the things that's slightly confusing to me about the programme is that it says that they would, so you obviously you wouldn't just do the test when the child is born, but as you say, you store the sample in a big kind of library of genomes. But it says they'll be kind of de-identified, so you can't, I guess, it's not going to be listed under your name, as it were. It'll just be a DNA sample of a human being to allow kind of research and that kind of thing. But then they also say that it will be a lifetime genomic record, which you could be reanalyzed in 30, 40 years' time when we have new technology. So how is that possible if it's been de-identified? I don't quite follow how it's going to be simultaneously this kind of resource for yourself and also a huge kind of library for other research.
We all have a unique genomic code, genetic code. So actually, you can never truly anonymize someone's genomic sequence because it would be unique to them. But you can de-identify it by storing the sort of identifying information, such as name, date of birth, etc., in a separate area. And we do currently have something called the National Genomics Research Library, which is storing information where families consent, their genomic sequence is stored as part of this national library, and people can apply to access it, and they have to go through kind of a proper application process, so not just anyone could access it. But what they could ultimately access is de-identified, so without your name, information to try and, you know, if it's a researcher who wants to analyse that. Controversially, there are also, you know, potentials in the future that could be used for commercial reasons, although, you know, there are sort of promises that it would never be able to be accessed by insurance companies, for example. But, you know, it's a really important question of who should be able to access that information and what can that information be used for. And we're at very early stages at the moment of this kind of development of this national resource. And certainly through the newborn screening, whole genome screening process, again, there's lots of questions about how could that information be used in the future.
And it does seem as though England in many ways is pushing ahead faster than most other countries in the world in this kind of area. And why do you think that is? Why should England be seen as pioneering this highly controversial and experimental approach?
So there was a commitment in the NHS long-term plan to deliver a certain amount of genomic testing. So the newborn screening wasn't part of that commitment, but there was a real commitment to make England and to make the NHS a pioneer and a world leader in genomic testing. And, you know, if we look back historically, if we look back sort of 10 years ago when London was hosting the Olympics, David Cameron, who was the Prime Minister at the time, had announced the 100,000 genomes project. And again, kind of historically, we've seen So the 100,000 Genomes Project was a project to sequence 100,000 genomes, which was a huge task. It took around 6 years. And this newborn whole genome sequencing project has kind of arisen as a further step out of the success of that project. And we do see over the past and of recent years, there is a real push in our country to be seen as world leaders in this area. But we have to be really careful, of course, when we're pushing forward with new technologies. Just because we can do something, of course, it doesn't always mean that we should do something. And we need to always be evaluating, well, what are the potential consequences if we do this?
And is it primarily coming from the politicians? Is it coming from the genetic scientists themselves? Is it coming from commercial, you know, the commercial potential, or is it all of those? What are the drivers behind this, do you think?
I think there's a real combination, and I think that, you know, genomic data and this concept of having access to big data, it is potentially a very powerful tool, and there are lots of people who could benefit from that. And so I think there are lots of key players who are really pushing this forward. And so I think, you know, it's the combination of all of those efforts really that are trying to push this forward.
And so then the question, of course, is then how, as a parent, is the idea that every parent would be approached and explained what this whole genome screening program was, counselled about the implications, and asked whether they wish their own baby to be part of the screening program? Is that the proposal?
So there's not a crystal clear published plan of exactly how the kind of counselling and things will work. And I don't have any kind of further access to information about that. But I think it is something certainly as a clinician that I think will be a really important area. Whenever we are doing whole genome sequencing as a test, we spend a great deal of time discussing with families the potential implications. And there are a lot of different potential implications. And it's something that families really need a lot of time to consider and a lot of information to consider. And so that sort of counselling about the testing will be hugely important. For me as a clinician, I have concerns about resources. So, you know, at the moment, it's taking nearly a year for us to get a lot of our results back for patients who were doing whole genome sequencing on. And, you know, we have a hugely stretched service already. and there are huge issues around both the sort of clinical genetics side of things and the lab genetics side of things, and ensuring that there are enough resources. And for this project to go ahead, I think we need to be really careful acknowledging that there are huge resource issues and making sure that families still get the time that they need to consider if this is actually something that they want to go ahead with.
Is there another issue around kind of the concept of giving informed consent? I mean, people will be familiar with the idea that, you know, before you, you know, go for an operation or any kind of treatment, the doctor sits you down and says, you know, I need to inform you so that you can give informed consent about whether you want to go ahead with this. And obviously, as you mentioned, it would be the parents giving consent on behalf of their child. But it's quite hard for that to be truly informed, because we don't know what it will mean to store my child's DNA for the whole of their life, because we have no idea in 2060 what implications having a full sequence of my genome will have, and what new diseases I might find, what new treatments might be available, what the cost benefit analysis of that will be. So it strikes me that giving truly informed consent for something so far reaching is quite difficult.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Tim. We are very careful in genetics when we think about the concept of consent, because, you know, as you've talked about going for surgery, a surgeon will often outline all of the possible outcomes, so bleeding, infection, death, even, etc. Whereas when we are doing genetic testing, because we are potentially testing for so many different things, we can't go through every possible outcome. So we can't really do this what we would historically call fully informed consent. So the findings that we might get from testing could be quite complex, they could be uncertain, they could be unexpected. And rather than talking about all of the different individual conditions, often what we would do is talk about the types of results that we might find. So for example, an unexpected finding. So we often talk about having a record of discussion rather than a patient signing a consent form, as might be done for surgical procedures.
I wonder if you are aware of or have any thoughts on the kind of concerns that some people, including Christians, might have about the kind of implications for society about building up an enormous library of children's genomes. Some people fear there might be kind of authoritarian political implications if a future government is able to kind of access and identify everyone's genetic information, that we're kind of giving away something quite personal and quite intimate, and not really sure if the people that we can trust those who hold on to it. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that angle, or how you'd respond to concerns if a parent raised some of those issues.
I think that from what I can understand of this process so far, that parents will be given a choice as to whether or not they will allow their data to also be used for the research purposes. Although, again, that's not completely clear. When we are doing whole genome sequencing for patients at the moment, we give them a choice as to whether or not they want to be part of that library of information. And it's always important to make sure their family understand what they're signing up to. But you have raised an issue, a bigger issue, about sort of that idea of big data. And I think that we have to be really careful with big data, because we've seen historically examples of how this can be really positive. And, you know, we can, on a population level, identify through big data, we've been able to identify things like modifiable risk factors for certain conditions. And that can be really helpful information. But we have also seen examples in society of big data being used for commercial gain or for other harmful purposes. And so I think, you know, it is a really challenging area deciding as an individual if you would want your genomic information to be stored that way. And as we've discussed, genomic information is unique to you. So even though it can be anonymized, it cannot be anonymized, it would be de-identified. And that's, again, quite an important concept to think about carefully. And, you know, as Christians, we see an example in the Bible that I often think of, thinking about the Tower of Babel, and, you know, that if we try and make us a name for ourselves, we need to be really careful that what we're doing is sort of aligning with God's will, rather than trying to make a name for ourselves as a country or as a profession, because, you know, otherwise there can be a harmful fallout from that. I think big data is a really complex area, and there's lots of sort of difficult things to discuss about that.
I mean, if you're taking a sort of slightly cynical or fatalistic view, you could say that basically we can't put the DNA genie back in the bottle. Ultimately, everyone is going to have their DNA sequenced, whether we like it or not, and it's going to be obtained by fair means or foul, and therefore maybe it's better to do it in this sort of highly regulated, carefully examined, publicly accountable method rather than in a more covert ways. I mean, think about the police building up its own DNA database. I suspect that once a national database is available, there will be all kinds of implications for law enforcement, for forensics, of all kinds of different implications. But maybe we can't stop that. Maybe it's going to happen anyway. What do you think about that?
I certainly know that the individuals that are running this newborn whole genome sequencing project are very keen on establishing trust, and they know that trust is necessary for the success of this project, and so they want to kind of encourage that. So I think that's kind of on an individual level. Individuals who are pushing this forward really want the public to trust this, and therefore are very careful about how the data will be used. But of course, you know, over time, data can be used in different ways, and things that were previously not thought to be acceptable might end up becoming acceptable. Something that always comes to mind for me, I'm not sure if many people here have watched the film Gattaca. I would really encourage you to watch it. It's about a sort of near dystopian future where individuals in society are sort of viewed based on their genetic code, and their place in society is determined by their genetic code. And it's a really interesting film that explores that further. And I think it's really important for us as Christians to be really careful of health inequalities that could arise as a result of understanding someone's genomic information. Because actually, you know, if you have an increased risk of cancers, for example, in the family, you have no control over that. It's not like you're a smoker and you can stop smoking, or that you don't exercise enough and you can do more exercise. Actually, you have no influence over your genetic code. And, you know, we should really be careful to be a voice for the vulnerable and make sure that individuals wouldn't be discriminated in that way. And of course, there is absolutely no intention for that at the present time. But it would be remiss of us to not think about possible ways that data could be misused, and to not try and safeguard against those for the future.
Yeah, I'd really echo that. Actually, I've seen Gattaca, and it's a really fascinating and concerning kind of imagination of what might happen in the future around DNA testing and genomes. And it strikes me, I mean, I was reading something just the other day about a growing kind of use of genomic sequencing in IVF in the States in particular, where it's quite unregulated, which there are certain companies that are now giving parents the chance to kind of create several embryos through IVF and then genetically sequence each of them and choose the ones, not just the ones that don't have, you know, a predisposition to breast cancer, but choose the ones which have genes associated with high intelligence or athletic prowess or various other supposedly desirable traits. And the author of this blog I read was kind of suggesting this could be a kind of novel version of genetic eugenics, almost, in which, you know, we are creating, trying to kind of meddle and create and create a new kind of superclass of humans based on their genes.
Absolutely. And even if we take out of the equation anyone's views on how they feel about reproductive technologies, if we think about who can access these resources, choosing the superior embryos, as it were, of course, it's going to be those that can afford to pay for it. And so even if we don't think about any of the ethical implications of reproductive technologies, we can already see that there would be new health inequalities imposed if someone that can afford to pay for a superior embryo is then able to do that, as opposed to someone else who can't afford to do that.
So I suppose one of the things that's behind this, which I'm really interested in, is an idea which is often called genetic determinism, which is basically that, you know, we're biological machines and we're programmed by our DNA. And the more we understand about DNA, the more we're then able to predict how people will behave. And in the end, this leads to a kind of devaluing of a reductionist understanding of what it means to be human. Do you think that those ideas are sort of gaining more currency in popular culture?
If we take in a clinical example, so one of the services that the NHS offers is predictive testing for Huntington's disease. So Huntington's is a really difficult disorder where someone will deteriorate, and if they have that condition, then there's a 50% or 1 in 2 chance that each of their children will be affected by that condition. And in the NHS, we offer testing for children once they've, you know, reached adulthood, once they're 18 or above, to access testing to see if they will develop Huntington's disease. And it's something quite different to a lot of the other testing that we do, because first of all, an individual will have to have quite a lot of counselling before we agree to do that testing. But secondly, if we do find that they do carry the genetic change that means that they will develop Huntington's, we cannot tell them what symptoms they will start with. We cannot tell them what age the condition will start at. And so they just have this vague understanding of, at some time in the future, they will develop Huntington's disease. Now, of course, there's a million and one things that could happen in between that. You know, they might get hit by a bus one day before they ever reach the age where they would have developed Huntington's. And having that knowledge, for some individuals, it's really empowering, and they will make different life decisions. And, you know, I saw a great example of someone who got really involved with a Huntington's disease charity and helping other people, because he knew that he at some point would likely develop that condition. But we also see families where there's family breakdown. Once someone knows that they have that condition, they think, actually, you know, I don't want to have my own children. I don't want to be with a partner because I don't want them to see this happen to me later in life. And so having an understanding of something that that would happen in the future if you live to the age where you would develop it, it's actually has huge implications for the way that you live day to day in the meantime. And it's really hard to know if an individual would use that information in a positive way or in a negative way. And even if they do use it in a positive way, it's hard to fully understand what's going on in their mind on a day to day basis of having to process the knowledge that will happen at some point in their life.
And I guess further from that, do you think as Christians we need to actively resist the idea that we are kind of prisoners of our biology, and that what is written into our genome determines not just our kind of physical characteristics and whether we have a certain disease, but who we are as people? And actually, as Christians, we have to constantly be trying to refound our identity in who we are in Christ, in the image of God, not in what we're looking on the inside of our genome.
I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, our identity as Christians is as children of God, and we know that the genome is corrupt and marred, and we know that we have a hope in an eternal hope that of restoration. And I'm not saying it's negative to always know this information, because it definitely for some families can be really helpful and really empowering, but it can also be, it's just really something that we shouldn't become sort of really preoccupied by, because actually, yes, our identity is as children of God. We might be children of God who on this earth have X condition, and we must be compassionate to recognise that actually a lot of genetic conditions can be completely life-changing and, you know, really difficult for families to manage, and we must always be compassionate about that. But first and foremost, we are, our identity is in being children of God rather than in our genome.
Well, we're kind of running out of time, but just before we end, Melody, there might be people listening to this who've been quite personally affected by what we've been talking about, who have some experience of this in their own families. Is there any kind of resources or anywhere you could signpost people to if they wanted to pursue this?
There's a really good charity called Unique, which we'll share the link for, but it's rarechromo.org. And that's a really helpful website, which sort of is quite a generic one that explores lots of different sort of chromosomal and some genetic disorders as well. For very specific conditions, there are lots of specific patient support groups as well, and I think quite often it can be helpful for individuals to be connected with other families. But also if this has affected you because you know someone who has a genetic condition or has difficult decisions to make around this area, you know, it's really important to walk alongside people and to be there to listen to them and explore these areas with, because they are new-ish areas and they're hard for people to wrestle with, and different families will come to different decisions about what's right for them. So, you know, walking alongside someone and being there through these difficult discussions and difficult decisions can be really powerful as well.
Brilliant. Yeah, thank you so much, Melody. It's been absolutely fascinating having you this week and last week digging through this really interesting area of genetics. We're so grateful for your expertise and your time. And thanks as always, John. And thank you to the listener. Thank you for going on this journey with us. I hope you found it interesting and useful. As always, there's lots of resources, including stuff on this area, if you want to read or listen or watch to on John's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. But otherwise, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.